Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. I'm going to call our last case, which is 03AP2662CR State v. James Brown. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Brown is Assistant State Public Defender Richard Martin. Mr. Martin.
Thank you, Chief Justice Abrahamson, and may it please the Court, I am Richard Martin. I represent James Brown, the defendant, appellant petitioner. One of my strengths and weaknesses is I spend too much time on the Internet, and I found this on the Internet the other day. It says, of this case stems from the conviction of a 17-year-old on charges that yielded a 25-year prison sentence. The Supreme Court is expected to clarify whether an illiterate defendant who answers a judge's questions with grunts and one-word responses has sufficiently demonstrated his understanding of a plea proceeding. That's from this Court's website, the synopsis of what this case is about.
We're not held to that, you know.
I just thought it was a nice introduction. It was better than my statement of the issue in my brief. And it was very convincing. Cecchini, however it's pronounced, was decided in June 1985. And then in June of 1986, Bangert, Carter, and Shegrin, that's State versus Bangert, State versus Carter, and State versus Shegrin, were decided in June of 1986. And those of us who have been doing this a fairly long time remember when Cecchini was decided. Some of us remember wondering how long it would last. And it lasted a year. And
that's pretty good.
For this Court.
I was thinking, if you had a legal observer, it doesn't matter who, a law student, a reporter, or an attorney, who read State versus Bangert and wondered how long it would take for Bangert and its mandates to trickle down to circuit courts, and imagine that person decided to play it safe and give the judges in Wisconsin 15 years to implement it. So he gets in a time machine, or she gets in a time machine, sets it for 15 years, and then walks into this courtroom in James Brown's case in the year 2001, almost exactly 15 years later, and here's this guilty plea colloquy. I think the observer would conclude one of two things. Either the time machine took him 15 years back, or it took him to a different state. That's how bad this colloquy is. The plea colloquy here was December 5 of 2001. An interesting thing that's appended to the state's brief, and I caught this, and I researched, as the Court knows, there are rules about what can go in an appendix, but there's a very interesting thing in the state's brief. It's a guilty plea questionnaire, but it's blank. And I think that tells us a lot about what happened here. It's blank. We don't know what Mr. Brown understood, what he knew, what he comprehended.
Well, didn't the lawyer say that they went through this?
The lawyer said that, and the lawyer says that in virtually every case where a plea is entered. And this Court said in Bangert, and even before Bangert, I believe in Ernst, that we can't rely on the lawyer to do this. The judge has a duty under the Constitution. And under 971-08, the judge has a duty to make sure the plea is knowing and voluntary.
Counselor, do you think we ought to set up different rules when we know we have a defendant before us who is illiterate?
I think that what the Court said in Bangert was the colloquy has to be a solemn, penetrating one, and it has to take into account the defendant's understanding and an ability to comprehend things. I don't have a particular rule in mind, but I think that there has to be a sensitivity to what can be understood, and whether you have to break concepts down into smaller pieces, whether you have to, I guess the place to start is there has to be a real colloquy, a real actual colloquy. There was no real colloquy here. There was no give and take. There was a series of questions, and as the Court knows, you got one-word answers to every one of them. So I think that even the State in their brief in this Court concedes there would be better practice with illiterate defendant to be more careful.
Counsel, are you saying that you have to have more than one word answers? I mean, if you look through, I'm sure you have. I won't say that standard, but generally, you get one yes, no, yeah. You know, I mean, those are the answers you get when you have a plea colloquy.
Well, Justice Wilcox, it's not whether I think one-word answers are good enough. It's whether this Court thinks so.
Well, I'm just saying, but in your experience, here you're saying, and I don't disagree with what you said, but you had, there were two judges here, right? There was Judge Donald and Judge Wagner. And there were, so your client appeared before both. And in what capacity, let's see, he went before Judge
Wagner. Wagner took the plea.
Took the plea.
And he also decided the post-conviction motion.
Okay, and Judge Donald
did the sentencing.
Did the sentencing.
Right.
Did he give him an opportunity at that point to talk about the plea colloquy or if he had any questions?
Well, it's interesting. It did come up in this sense after this plea was entered, when the defendant was being interviewed by the pre-sentence report writer, the author. As the Court can see from my brief and from the pre-sentence report itself, he never admitted to any of the offenses to the pre-sentence writer. It became very clear that his account of everything was exculpatory. And that came up at sentencing. And defense counsel, Mr. Earle, was obviously perplexed by that. And he said, you know, maybe I should have been more careful in preparing for this plea, at least with regard to the sexual assault count. Perhaps we should have done a no contest plea on that. Now, Judge Donald was doing the sentencing. He was not, as I said, the plea judge. And so he had no idea what had transpired at that other plea hearing. There was no transcript in existence at that point.
Was that hearing good enough before that judge to repair any damage at the Bangor? Because don't you, I can't remember precisely which case, said, oh, you look at the whole record. You just don't look at one part of the record.
Right. Well, first of all, no, it wasn't sufficient to repair anything because, again, there was no colloquy. The defendant just persisted in his plea. But you got a defense attorney saying, looking at what the defendant has said in the pre-sentence report, perhaps this should have been a no-contest plea, at least as to this count. There was no colloquy about the difference between a no-contest plea and a guilty plea or an offered plea and a guilty plea. There was no discussion. I mean, this is... There was no attempt, again, to engage the defendant in a colloquy where you say, Mr. Brown, you've told the pre-sentence writer you didn't commit any crime, and yet you've entered a guilty plea before Judge Wagner on a prior date.
In light of the sentencing, did he waive this objection?
If waiver means knowing involuntary relinquishment of a right, I don't see how you could find anything knowing voluntary about a defendant who, by his own attorney's admission, was unprepared for the first plea, who is now at the day of sentencing. There's no colloquy about, you know, if you persist in this plea now, you're going to give up your right to a post-conviction motion or to withdraw the plea. I don't think there's anything even remotely approaching that, and I don't think the state's even suggested that in their briefs, either here or in the Court of Appeals.
Can I follow up on the Chief's question? I'm looking at page 35 of the sentencing transcript where Judge Donald asked Mr. Brown and defense counsel, well, at this point, there was a guilty plea entered. Is there a motion being made to withdraw the guilty plea on the first count of the first-degree sexual assault? And Mr. Earls responds, the defense attorney, no, I went over the mechanics of that last night with him. The court, following some comments from the prosecutor, says, all right, I understand the arguments that are being made. They're being made for sentencing purposes. But at this point, the record reflects that the defendant entered a guilty plea to the count. But there's no indication, I'm skipping over to the part that's relevant, but there's no indication that Mr. Earle is making any motion to withdraw that plea. Mr. Brown, it's been argued to this court that you're denying any involvement in the first-degree sexual assault, count one, and that at this time you are not asking this court to withdraw your plea to that count. Is that correct? Yeah. Yes. And he further asks about the fact that he's going to sentence him on that count, and then finds that the guilty plea was entered, and he's going to be sentenced on that count, and I'm going to proceed to sentencing on that count. Given that type of interaction that takes place there, your remedy, what you've asked us to do, is remand this to the circuit court to give him an opportunity to withdraw his plea.
On all accounts.
On all accounts. But my question is, didn't Judge Donald go through that with him before the sentencing?
But the problem is, and this gets into the difficulty that Justice Wilcox alluded to, where you've got two judges. Judge Donald has no idea how thorough or sketchy the first colloquy is. And I think he just doesn't know. If you stipulate that the first colloquy was inadequate, and then the second colloquy here, if you want to call it that, is simply a discussion whether he wants to withdraw his plea as to one count. If the things he's saying, the defendant is saying through counsel and in the pre-sentence had been said at the time of the plea shouldn't have been taken to begin with. The court should have rejected it. Minaszewski says if you won't waive your rights, the court can set it for trial. Henderson v. Morgan and other cases from this court say that if the plea doesn't constitute a knowing and intelligent admission to what the crimes are, you don't take the plea. And then if you want to have a no-contest plea, there are separate rules for that. There are separate rules for an Alford plea. And what is this plea now based on these, I don't know what you call them, but these developments in the pre-sentence and the sentencing transcript? There's never a discussion here of a no-contest versus a guilty plea, so this doesn't cure anything.
I wasn't suggesting that this would cure. I guess my question is a different one, that if the remedy that you're requesting is to allow him to go back to give him an opportunity to withdraw the plea, and he's given at least arguably the opportunity before the sentencing, while it may not rectify the plea, do you have an issue of waiver here?
Well,
following up on the Chief's question, same question.
You might have an issue of waiver of the, well, you have an issue of waiver of the more liberal pre-sentencing standard. And, but that's not what this appeal is about. This appeal is about whether the whole plea was voluntarily, knowingly, intelligently entered under the Constitution, under 97108, under this Court's law. Yes, if I was saying that the Court should, that there should have been some pre-sentence attempt to withdraw the plea, and then we got to this point in the record and we realized, well, he had a chance to do it. But even there, at least only, it was only as to one count. It wasn't as to all the counts. And it's not at all clear to me that he understood. We don't know what Mr. Earle told him that night before. We know that there was a discussion. That discussion's not spread on the record. We don't know if Mr. Earle explained the manifest injustice standard or the fair and just reason pre-sentencing standard. We don't know if there was a discussion. Mr. Earle virtually concedes there was no discussion of the difference between a no-contest plea and a guilty plea. So if by the defendant's choosing not to withdraw the plea, this has sort of transmutated this into a no-contest plea, this isn't a valid no-contest plea either. I guess that's my answer to that. In Banger, the court said in real unmistakable terms that the time had come, the time had arrived to mandate the trial courts do this right. And what I find remarkable is that 15 years later, it's still not happening. My dad used to say, anything worth doing is worth doing right. The point here is that it doesn't take that much longer to do a proper plea. It doesn't take that much longer to follow the script in SM 32, ask the questions, and follow up on the answers you get. When you're a circuit judge sitting in court, you've been told the defendant's illiterate, truly illiterate, not a bad reader, a non-reader. And you say if you graduate high school, it shows a certain disconnect between the information you're getting from counsel and the questions you're asking of the defendant. In this court's recent Hampton decision, this court made very clear that there's an easy way for trial courts to avoid these problems, and that's to do it right the first time. The court said in paragraph 65, the best defense against an allegation that the defendant didn't understand the court's role in sentencing in the wake of a plea agreement is an explicit colloquy in the transcript of the plea hearing establishing the defendant understood the court was not bound by the terms of the plea agreement. The court has the means to virtually eliminate this ground for plea withdrawal. And the court went on to say that that's why there's a lower, the allegation, the specificity of the allegation of not understanding is a lower burden than in a Bentley plea withdrawal motion.
Mr. Markin, it's my understanding that academicians as well as judges, disagree with this court's approach in a number of instances where a court says to the trial court, you got to make a record, and that you've got to do it personally and not rely on lawyers. and that it's a waste of time to do that. The defendant has a lawyer, constitutionally required to give him one if he doesn't, can't afford it. The lawyer says he or she did it. To go through the, in effect, to go through the plea questionnaire in open court is not the way to handle it with a defendant, literate, illiterate, 17-year-old, 50-year-old. The way to handle it is you say to the lawyer, who is an officer of the court, did you do it? Does he understand? Do you have any doubts, et cetera, whatever you want to ask the lawyer. That this plea colloquy, as well as other colloquies, are just formal, ritualistic, and meaningless. Because the judge is not going to find out enough unless the judge spends a lot of time, half hour, an hour, asking the defendant questions and getting responses that are not, yeah, but, well, you understand the sentence. What do you think it is? Testing whether there's real understanding. So why don't we get rid of Bangor and just say, hey, it's all on the lawyer's head. If a lawyer doesn't do it, then it's ineffective assistance of counsel. We upset the verdict or the plea or whatever it is in that form. Instead of saying to the busy trial court, we're in Milwaukee County, right? Instead of saying this judge who now has a ritual that he should have read from a book, right? The bench book probably has the ritual and other materials have a mere ritual. Why don't we just say, forget it. Forget it. Hold her all responsible.
I have so many answers to that question. I'm afraid I'll use my time up on them. Number one. What's that?
Try your best.
Try my best. Well, my best answer is the lawyer's not the one doing the time.
That's true, but he could after a while if he really is going to do time out.
Right. But,
right? Time out of practice.
The court is sentencing a defendant. It's the defendant's knowledge and understanding that is crucial here, and it's important that the court have that on the record. And we are decades past any time when that would work. This court and the U.S. Supreme Court have repeatedly said what's at issue is defendant's understanding, and this court has stressed the paramount duty of the trial court to make that record. And it's not just a ritual, and it doesn't take that long. That's what's so striking to me about this, is I've read, as a court can imagine, hundreds of guilty plea transcripts. The ones that are done right are just a few pages longer. Take 5, 8, 10 minutes more. Do we really want to start having guilty plea withdrawal motions always couched in the context of ineffective counsel?
Well, do you have, since you've read hundreds of these, do you find that there are some trial courts that are consistently good at this and some courts that are consistently not good?
Am I allowed to say or should I just say yes? The answer is yes.
Yes,
Chief Justice Abramson. There are some courts that consistently get it right time after time after time, and there are some courts that do otherwise.
Well, what do you suggest the court do about judges who do it otherwise?
Well, in Bangor, this court said judicial discipline would be sufficient. Chief Justice Heffernan wrote a concurrence in which you joined Chief Justice Abramson, suggesting that was a hollow threat and it wouldn't happen. And I think history has shown that he was right. This trial judge in particular, and I
try to stay away from this in the briefs, but it has to be said. You read State versus Hall,
Court of Appeals decision, State versus Hall, which I don't think is in the briefs, 2002 WIAP 108, 2002 WIAP 108, and 255 with second 662, 255 with second 662. This trial judge has been reversed over and over and over and over for either bad plea colloquies, or sentencings in which the totality of the circumstances explain the sentence. And Judge Schutzen wrote a concurrence in Hall listing 7 or 8 mostly unpublished cases. Judge Schutzen opined that 20% of District 1's caseload was coming from this one circuit court. So yes, there are some judges that routinely do it well, and there are some that do something different.
Mr. Martin, let me ask you about what I perceive to be an internal inconsistency in the Bangert decision. And I have to confess I did not go back and read Henderson v. Morgan in preparation for the argument. I did read the Bangert case. But the court in Bangert on pages 19 and 20, referring to Henderson, indicated that the Supreme Court in Henderson intimated that a state trial court may appropriately presume that in most cases defense counsel routinely explain the nature of the charge to the defendant. Counsel's explanation thereby would give the accused sufficient notice of the true nature of the charge, citing Henderson at page 647. Then you go to page 270, I believe, of the Bangert decision, and this court, and just an opinion written by Justice Cecil, brings it together and says, defense counsel may not speak for the defendant. The defendant must affirmatively state his own knowledge and understanding when he is capable of doing so. Do you find anything inconsistent about what happened in Henderson and how it relates to what this court did in Bangert?
Well, I'm in the same position you are, which is I haven't read Henderson in a long time. I'd read it carefully years ago on another case I litigated. As I recall, Henderson says if you deny an element of the crime, that's a reason to reject the plea. That's part of what Henderson's about. I don't know. I guess I don't have a good answer for that question at this point. I'm not sure what you're getting at, frankly.
Well, my only concern is to follow up to the Chief's question also, but it has to deal with this. When you're looking at the record to see whether or not the plea is a knowing, intelligent, and voluntary one, there is a record in this case from Mr. Earle that he explained all of this stuff to Mr. Brown, that he did so prior to the plea, and then he came back and that there were some problems at the time of sentencing, and he re-explained it the night before. Now, there's at least arguably something in the record to suggest that it had been explained in the record to the defendant. It was not explained by the trial court in the record. But and when reading through Bangert, the Bangert list is not exhaustive. So that's my concern.
Well, there are several more parts of my answer that I'm kind of using your question as a way to get at. One is, a lawyer may say things to a client that doesn't guarantee the client understood them. I can remember vividly a personal experience in the last year and a half, where I spent 30 minutes explaining to a client various ins and outs of issues and strategy and appellate stuff about his case. And he nodded and he listened patiently. He didn't interrupt. He seemed to be undertaking it all in. Really seemed like he got it. And then when he started asking questions, I realized he got about 30% of it at best. So, number one, we don't know what the quality of the communication is between the lawyer and the client. Number two, you don't know how accurate and complete the information the lawyer has. I have had plea transcripts and plea colloquies that I've gotten reversed in trial courts where the lawyer didn't know what the elements of the crime were, or the lawyer misstated an element of the crime. And so that goes back to my sort of flippant answer, the lawyer's not doing the time, but it is really important that the defendant know what he is pleading to and what he's admitting to or she's admitting to. And so that's why Bangert, I believe, says, yes, you can have the lawyer explain things, but then you have to spread that on the record. The lawyer has to explain to the judge in a summary fashion what the discussion was. For instance, it's not that hard to say, Judge, I went through Wisconsin jury instructions number and then list them for kidnapping, armed robbery, sexual assault. I went through each one of them with him. I read him the elements. I asked him if he understood those elements. And in fact, here, some lawyers in Milwaukee append the jury instructions to the plea questionnaire. And so there you've got a summary. You know that the attorney went through the elements, and there's a documentary record there. Behind part of your question, Chief Justice Abrahamson, is can a trial court properly delegate some of this to a lawyer? Of course.
Right. Mm-hmm. But that's my question.
I'm sorry?
That is my question.
But whose ultimate responsibility is it to make sure the plea is voluntary, intelligent, and knowing? The trial judge. And
had the trial judge, in this case, said, I'm delegating it to the lawyer, or that was the rule of the case, the trial judge might not have been put on any notice And this court might not be put on any notice that there may be a problem, right?
I think I missed the first word or two of your question.
Well, if the rule of law was to, it's okay to delegate to the trial lawyer, the judge would have talked to the lawyer. The lawyer might or might not have said that the defendant is illiterate. Lawyer would have said, explained everything on the plea questionnaire. Not once, not twice, but three times. Talked it over with him. Everything's A-okay. Mm-hmm. The judge would never have had any reason to question. And this court would have no reason to question. Unless there was an ineffective assistance of counsel and these facts came out. That he's illiterate, he's young, I don't know what his other problems might be. These other problems are that he really doesn't think he's guilty.
I'm not sure. Is there a question?
Yes. I want to know if we have a lawyer do it all, there'd be no indication on the record there was a problem.
Right. And this court has said you can't have the lawyer do it all. And this court has said more than once there's a trial court obligation here. And the statute, 971-08, says the trial court has to satisfy itself that the defendant understands the nature of the offenses to which he pleads. I mean,
constitutionally required or just statutory?
The Constitution requires that the plea be knowing and voluntary.
I understand that.
And the statute lays out some specific things that have to be a part of that picture. And we're talking about fundamentally obeying those statutes. These statutes bind judges in our state. And when they don't obey them, it's essentially, I think it speaks for itself. And the statute puts that duty on the judge. It's just the way it is.
Mr. Martin, what would you say was the most egregious deficiency, in your view, in the plea colloquy?
I don't think I have time. I mean, the most egregious one is, I think, never discussing the elements of any of the crimes or making clear to the defendant that his pleas constituted admission of those elements. Not once. I mean, there's a formalistic going through some of the things in the guilty plea questionnaire, but not once was an element of any crime discussed with this defendant. And if I can, in the preliminary hearing transcript, the defendant waived the preliminary hearing. The court commissioner there was not content with one-word answers. He made the defendant say in his own words what a preliminary hearing was, and he wasn't going to take the waiver until he got it. And that's just a preliminary hearing, just for a bindover. I mean, the difference is so stark here. But I think the most efficient thing, the most egregious thing is you can't tell what this defendant understood about what this whole proceeding was about. I see my red light's been on for a while.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. William C. Wolford, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state of Wisconsin.
May it please the Court, William C. Wolford, representing the state in this appeal. Before I get into the colloquy itself and whatever alleged deficiencies exist in it, I'd like to discuss the matter of pleading that we raised in our brief. In State v. Bangert, this Court provided that a defendant may move to withdraw his plea when the procedures outlined in 971.08 are not undertaken or other court-mandated duties at the plea hearing aren't fulfilled. However, in order to shift the burden to the State to show that the defendant's plea was knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently entered, the defendant must show a violation of that statute or other mandatory duties and allege that he in fact did not know or understand the information which should have been provided at the plea hearing. The Court has recently reiterated this in State v. Hampton. In regard to the second part of defendant's burden, the post-conviction motion in this case states that, quote, counsel has discussed the issues raised herein and represents that Mr. Brown appears to understand very little of what transpired in connection with the entry of his guilty pleas. His testimony will make that clear beyond dispute. We contend that this allegation was insufficient to shift the burden to the state and warrant an evidentiary hearing. It isn't specific enough. It is too vague. There's no reason that the defendant couldn't have specifically alleged in his post-conviction motion what information he did or did not understand, even if he was unable to read. Requiring a defendant to specifically allege what information he did or didn't understand serves a real purpose. The allegations in the post-conviction motion determine the proper scope of the evidentiary hearing and what the state's going to have to show to meet its burden of showing that the plea was voluntary. Whatever this court chooses to do in this case, we request that the court make clear in its opinion that the allegations in the post-conviction motion in this case about a lack of knowledge or understanding must be specific. Defense counsel suggested initially that the allegations weren't more specific because the defendant couldn't read. This case could come back on ineffective assistance ground if this court decides that the pleading was inadequate in this case. If this court concludes the circuit court didn't adequately fulfill some of its duties in taking the plea, we would suggest a possible remedy as follows. Remand the case back to the circuit court and allow the defendant to file a new post-conviction motion on those issues on which the court determines the circuit court was deficient, and require in that post-conviction motion that the defendant specifically allege what he didn't understand so that the issues can be properly framed for the post-conviction hearing. Now as to the colloquy itself.
Now how does your remedy differ from Mr. Martin, who on page 31 says, this court should vacate the trial court's order denying post-conviction relief and remand with instructions to give Mr. Brown an evidentiary hearing on his plea withdrawal motion?
It differs in the sense that we would be, if the court finds there are deficiencies in certain areas, it differs in that we would be saying on remand, the defendant has to file a new post-conviction motion which specifically alleges what he didn't understand with respect to the deficiencies in the colloquy so that the evidentiary hearing issues can then be properly framed.
But if he says, I didn't understand the necessary elements to make this a voluntary and a knowing waiver, is that enough?
We believe that there should be some specificity in that claim. If he didn't understand any of the elements, he should allege that. If he didn't understand certain other specific elements but understood others, that he should allege that. That seems to be something that would be beneficial in determining what the issues are going to be at the evidentiary hearing and what the state has to prove to meet its burden once the burden is shifted.
What did the motion here say?
It said, counsel has discussed the issues raised herein and represents that Mr. Brown appears to understand very little of what transpired in connection with the entry of his guilty pleas. His testimony will make that clear beyond dispute.
Counsel, so if I understand you right, what you're suggesting is that if we remand it, a new post-conviction motion can be filed, and in that motion, each element of each offense to which he pled should be identified, and he should say why he didn't understand that those acts constituted the crime of which he was convicted?
Well, I certainly wouldn't object to the last bit that you put on there. That wasn't really necessarily part of the proposal. It was just what specific elements he didn't understand. If that was what the deficiency that the court found was, if the court found that there was a problem with knowing what the potential punishment was, then he would have to allege that he didn't understand it or what about it he didn't understand with more specificity.
Thank you.
Mr. Walford, I'm looking at State versus Hampton in paragraph 47. The court stated that to obtain an evidentiary hearing based upon defects in the plea colloquy, the defendant will rely on the plea hearing record. to rebut the defendant's motion to withdraw his plea because the plea was not allegedly knowing, voluntary, and intelligent. The State will likely rely on the totality of the evidence, much of which will be found outside the plea hearing record. And it cites the State versus Banger. When I looked at the plea hearing looked at the rest of the record in this case, I looked at the initial appearance where there was no waiting of the reading of the complaint. The complaint was not read. The complaint was amended, and the parties proceeded. I looked at the preliminary hearing transcript. There was no reading of the complaint. No one went through the elements at the prelim waiver. I looked at the motion hearing. There was nothing there where anything was read to the defendant on the record. We looked at the plea hearing. That's what this case is all about. The elements weren't read on the record. And then you get to the sentencing transcript, and there's nothing read in the sentencing transcript. Now, even if we were to go outside of the record in this case to determine whether or not this defendant had ever been advised of the elements of the offense, where are we going to find that?
Well, I think probably what would happen in this case is that it would go back and the defense counsel would be called by the State and he would testify as to what he told the defendant about the elements. That would be my guess as to the primary basis for
And assuming that that happened, how is a court to ascertain or determine the defendant's understanding of that interaction that is not part of the record, not done in court, that the defendant actually understood, even if the attorney explained? How is the court supposed to make that evaluation?
Well, I think they would do it both from probably the defense attorney's evaluation at that post-conviction hearing of what they believed the defendant understood, and the fact that the defendant stated at the plea hearing that he understood everything, never gave any indication that he didn't understand anything the whole plea hearing. And also at the plea hearing, defense counsel said that he had explained this and he believed that the defendant understood the elements and the other various things that were discussed. So I think that would primarily be it. I agree with you that there aren't any other parts of the record that I'm aware of where there was discussion of these various things, as there are in some cases.
So the thing that's deficient about his motion, which I have found in the record at 20, is he says as an introduction, guilty pleas were neither knowing nor voluntary. None of the elements of the crime were recited or discussed. Guilty plea fails to demonstrate he actually understood the elements or the way, rights way. The record nowhere contains an accurate and complete recitation of the potential penalties, nor the possibility of consecutive sentence. Then it goes on to say it's the trial court's duty to ensure, and then repeats the record that doesn't ensure. So what you want is, you want a much shorter motion, and all you need is and then he asks for a hearing. Burden will be on the State to demonstrate by clear and convincing evidence that the plea is nonetheless constitutionally voluntary. Do you agree with that? If we send this back for a hearing, that you have the burden of proof?
Yes.
All right. Because the record isn't clean, therefore you'd have the burden of proof. Okay. So what do you want his motion to say? You don't want any of this legal stuff. You just want the motion to say that that my client alleges, this is a motion. You want an affidavit attached to it?
Well, the reason I raise this is twofold. One is we want the court's opinion to indicate that there should be some specificity in that second prong of the burden in order to shift the burden, as far as explaining what isn't understood. And it's particularly difficult in this particular case where so many things are kind of thrown against the wall without a real clear understanding of what's being relied on, but then there's no specificity as to what he didn't understand. Now, in the particular case, there's no sense in requiring a post-conviction hearing saying he didn't understand something that this court has already determined in the opinion wasn't a problem in the colloquy. It would only be those things that you determine the plea colloquy is deficient on. But then we're suggesting, as kind of a compromise, this isn't something that would be typically done, but because there was this issue about
that's what I'm trying to get
him, at. Him not being able to read or whatever, and that's why it was so vague, that he would, as to those issues where the colloquy was deficient, what he didn't understand about that information that was provided.
For this case only, not as a general rule.
That's correct.
Okay. I didn't understand that.
Yes,
thank you.
That's just as kind of a compromise in this particular case, but that wouldn't be the standard procedure.
So, Anna, the standard procedure is to file a motion and indicate there were problems on the record.
Right.
And therefore, not understanding.
Indicate with more specificity what he didn't understand.
I need to follow up on that, because the first thing the defendant has to do is make a prima facie showing of a Bangert violation.
Right.
Okay. And so let's say the violation is elements were never explained.
Right.
Okay. Then he has to allege that he did not know or understand the information that should have been provided. You know, cite a number of cases. I mean, this is boilerplate stuff. So what do you want more than that in this case? I mean, it seems to me if you cite the violation, no elements, and then you allege, as our case law indicates, that you allege that you did not know or understand the information, the elements, that should have been provided.
I don't think in this case that the defendant did meet that burden. I don't think he did allege that he didn't understand the elements. The allegation about lack of understanding is much more general and much more vague in this case.
Okay.
Now, I understand you didn't take this case to decide that issue. But you probably will want to get to the issues as to what was deficient, if anything, about the plea colloquy. But I'm saying as a possible remedy in this particular case, that would be to file a new post-conviction motion if it goes back.
But if he, and what I'm trying to do is to make sure I understand how specific your specificity request is in this case.
I think with respect to the elements, if he didn't understand all the elements, he says, I didn't understand any of the elements.
That's enough, because that then puts the prosecution, when the burden is shifted, to know what's being alleged.
But if he understood three of the elements and didn't understand two of them.
Counsel, I'm having some of the same problem that I think Justice Bradley is. The word elements requires a certain understanding when you use it. He can better understand, did you have a gun? Did you point the gun at the defendant? And my concern is knowing what you are expecting from us. Because if you get a motion back that just says, I didn't understand the elements of sexual assault, well, what acts comprise those elements and what is it about those acts that you didn't understand? That's the problem I'm having with what you're asking us. If we're just going to say what elements, I don't think we're going to get anything back that's any more specific than what we have. I didn't understand the elements. Okay. I mean, I don't know what he understood or didn't understand if he tells me that. Do you?
It's somewhat difficult. Yeah.
The element really is a part of the crime, but that's something that most defendants, I think it's more helpful to the court to have defendants say what acts they understood or didn't understand made up the crime of which they're charged. Am I making it less clear or more clear?
No, I understand what you're saying. And in some of the cases that I see, it is very helpful when there's an allegation that is of the elements as tied into the facts of the particular case. Then you really can hone in on what the issue is at the post-conviction hearing. But I do see a lot of cases where they just say we didn't understand the elements, and that's more specific than in this case, but it could be better.
Thank you.
Mr. Wolford, I'm looking at page 10 of the state's brief. And at the very top of page 10, you state, Brown may have made a prima facie showing that the circuit court did not sufficiently comply with Bangert or 97108 with respect to Brown's understanding of the nature of the crimes for which he was convicted. Now, given the discussion I've been listening to for the last several minutes, what did you mean by that? If indeed you're conceding that he made a prima facie case, what kind of specificity beyond what he did are you asking for?
Well, I think they're unrelated. I'll explain what I mean by this, but I'll go to the other issue first. Prima facie showing by a defendant as far as the elements not being provided, but the defendant might not be able to allege at all in a post-conviction motion that he didn't understand them because he had them explained to him by his defense counsel, and he doesn't win in that case.
Hey, so, you're not at this point conceding that there was a prima facie case made out in regard to violation of Bangert concerning elements. Is that what I'm trying to
say? Even for the sake of argument, there was a prima facie case made out. Our pleading concern as to what you did or didn't understand would still exist.
You still want it more specific.
Yes. Now, as to what I meant by this, I'm really not certain. I believe that because Bangert discussion of the elements is, it says it's not exhaustive of the three ways are not exhaustive, that what was done in this case did satisfy Bangert in the sense that he asked counsel several times whether the elements had been explained in several different ways, and he got that information. Counsel said that he believed that the defendant understood it. And then he asked the defendant several times, and the defendant indicated he understood with no indication that he didn't. Now, I understand that he was told, that the trial court was told that he was a non-reader, but that doesn't mean that Mr. Brown was unable to comprehend anything. And he didn't really give any indication during the hearing that he didn't understand anything.
Mr. Wolford, with respect specifically to that, one of the things that Bangert and Hampton pointed out is that one of the ways you could ascertain that understanding is to ask the defendant's counsel whether he explained the nature of the charge to the defendant, which you're asserting, and request him to summarize the extent of the explanation, including a reiteration of the elements.
Yes, and he did.
That part was not done.
And he did not do that in this case. He did not comply with two, but I mean, it's arguable the fact that he discussed it with defense counsel and then got from Brown an agreement that he understood them is a combination that satisfies because those three are not exhaustive.
The problem is, if the attorney had repeated on the record the elements, then the judge says to the defendant, do you understand that? He says, yeah. So what you have on the record is a statement of the elements, which if are correct, that's great. If they're not, that raises lots of other problems. Whereas if you don't have the lawyer do it in court, then what is lacking is a record on court. Because all you have is the lawyer saying, I did everything correctly.
That's true, and the primary reason I changed my position slightly from the Court of Appeals to this court is that Brown did not cite the Lange case in the Court of Appeals, didn't cite anything specifically that indicated, you know, there has to be some indication of the elements in the record somewhere. And I think Lange, as I indicated in my brief, is distinguishable, but it did give me some pause, and I'm just really not absolutely certain as to what I don't think it's clear, and I don't think it's clear to the Court of Appeals either, because they said that this was sufficient in this case.
My read of Bangert had been, you know, maybe it changed, but when it was discussing, when the court was discussing the necessity for the court to make sure that the defendant understands the elements of the offenses, and then lists three ways you can do it, and then indicates it's not exhaustive, as you say. But each of those three ways required some reference to the record. Number one, the trial court has to give the elements on the record to the defendant. Number two, the trial court can ask the attorney if he has explained it to the defendant, and then the trial court asks the attorney to summarize the elements on the record. Number three, you can read the complaint, you know, like the old, you know, theft of taking movable property, you know, without owner's consent.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the reading of the complaint has the elements of the offense, and so the third way that's set forth in Bangert is reading aloud or making, you know, the what's in the complaint sufficing for the elements. Now, although the Bangert court says it's not exhaustive, each of their examples has the information someplace in the record. So I always, certainly as a trial court judge, and thought that that was the law. Show me why I should reconsider that understanding of the law.
The third way also, I don't have Bangert in front of me, but also talks about or other evidence, some language like that in addition to the record. And, I mean, you could say that that other evidence in this case was the defense counsel's statement.
It does say exactly what you're saying.
But the examples don't.
Yeah, it says, for example, it's got to be in the record.
the other thing that made it seem somewhat unclear to me is if you look at the plea questionnaire that I put in my appendix here, the first understandings says, I understand that the crimes to which I am pleading has had elements that the state would have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt if I had a trial. These elements have been explained to me by my attorney or are as follows, and then there's a box where you can have an attached sheet. So even the plea questionnaire doesn't require that those elements be expressed in writing or in an attached sheet. It can be done by the by a discussion with the attorney. I don't think it's as clear as it could be. If the elements have to be in the record somewhere, then there's a prima facie case here, probably. And
Mr. Wolford, what exactly did the state allege that Mr. Brown did in first-degree sexual assault while armed?
Well, it was a party to a crime charge, but if you look at the complaint says, to my recollection, that the victim had a gun put to her head by Mr. Brown while she was forced to have sex with another of the three people that were involved, and then Mr. Brown had sex with her as well, and then the third person had sex with her. And the complaint also has a statement given by Mr. Brown to the police where he indicated that he had intercourse with the victim. Now, as was discussed a little while ago at sentencing, he was saying, oh, I didn't ever have sexual intercourse with her at all. But
now, there was a Mr. Johnson, Edward Johnson?
Yes, he was one of the defendants.
What happened in that case?
I'm not sure that I know exactly what happened.
Has Mr. Brown ever testified in any other case?
I'm not sure.
Mr. Wolford, if this court were to conclude that we have here a Bangert violation and that there is no record or evidence in the record of an explanation or understanding of the elements. So starting with that,
My question then goes to the sentencing proceeding that took place between Judge Donald and Mr. Earle and the defendant, in this case, Mr. Brown. If there is no knowing, intelligent, and voluntary waiver of the plea, does that interaction between Judge Donald and those two individuals, is that enough to constitute a knowing, intelligent, and voluntary waiver of a right to withdraw the plea? In other words, is there enough there for that?
Quite honestly, I don't think that there is. I don't think that that after the fact would prevent him from claiming that his plea was not voluntary and intelligent at the time of the plea hearing. There might be some sort of waiver as to guilty versus no contest, and Judge Donald clearly gave him an opportunity to withdraw that plea at that point, and he chose not to. But I don't think it prevents him from raising the issue that he's raising now, and certainly not as to the other charges in this case. There are two other. That really was related just to that one charge. As far as the other alleged deficiencies, we just don't think that there's any basis to them. The potential punishment, the circuit court advised the defendant as to each count that he faced a maximum sentence of 60 years imprisonment. The defendant didn't cite any authority for the proposition that that the court has to explain that they are consecutive. In fact, we think would be an odd belief for a defendant to think that the maximum he could get would be the maximum on one of the counts, regardless of how many charges he was convicted of. And if you look at footnote 2 of SM 32, it suggests that if a sentence is required to be imposed consecutively, such as a sentence for escape, this should be disclosed. And this seems reasonable, but that's not the situation we have here. In addition, the defendant was facing 60 years on each count, a total of 180 years, and he only got 50 years of imprisonment, which was less than the maximum just on the one count. And we don't feel there's anything wrong with the discussion of the constitutional rights. He went over that at the plea hearing, the circuit court did, and he also confirmed with the defendant and the counsel that counsel had read to him every sentence in the plea questionnaire that he had in court. Now, even if the plea questionnaire never got filed, we know that the plea questionnaire has a discussion of the waiver of rights, and I think you could take judicial notice of that fact. So,
is there any problem with the fact that, as I understood it, Judge Wagner instructed the defense attorney to go ahead and get a signed waiver, and that never took place here?
Your answer is yes. You're nodding your head, and it won't be picked up on the computer.
Is there any problem with that?
How does that, I mean, you've attached the plea questionnaire. I know Judge Wagner asked that defense counsel get a signed copy of the plea questionnaire, yet a signed copy never made it to the file. That was never done.
Right.
So we don't have, and I was curious about this when you were making the argument about the questionnaire before, we don't have anything here indicating from the defendant that he signed a plea questionnaire, that he signed off on this, even though it was requested by the trial judge. And I guess my question goes to whether or not the trial judge is part of the judge's responsibility, could rely upon defense counsel doing that. In other words, he's asked for it, he's expecting it to get into the record, it just never shows up.
Well, first of all, Mr. Martin indicated in his brief that I was putting the blame on trial counsel in this case. It's clearly the trial court's responsibility to do all these things. I was just trying to put that in context as to what had happened. And I don't think it has any actual impact in this case because there was clear testimony, clear acknowledgement at the plea hearing that trial counsel had gone through every word of those plea questionnaires with the defendant, and the defendant indicated that in addition, as to waiver of rights and that sort of thing, that and punishment, that was all discussed in the colloquy, if there's a problem, it's really with the elements. And that wouldn't, the plea questionnaire, the blank one doesn't help on that, obviously, because we don't know how it would have been filled in. So, thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Martin.
Justice Rogensack asked a very good question that helped me crystallize in my mind. I was very frustrated not being able to give a good answer to the chief about what's wrong with delegating it to the lawyer. I was frustrated I didn't give a good answer to Justice Wilcox about what's wrong with one-word answers. But her question crystallized the problem. A guilty plea record has to show the defendant understood the law in relation to the facts. What's lying behind her question, I think, is it's like trying to nail gel to a wall in this case. I had that frustration in trying to craft a motion that was faithful and accurate and adequate and set forth what I understood, the defendant understood or didn't understand. There's a line in Hampton, paragraph 59, that's just it's a great line. It says, it would be considerably more difficult to expand on an allegation that the defendant did not understand information that was not conveyed to him. It's very difficult to explain what you don't understand.
Here's what Bangert says. Whenever the 97108 procedure is not undertaken, or whenever the court-mandated duties are not fulfilled at the plea hearing, and that's your position here, right?
Right.
The defendant may move to withdraw his plea. The initial burden rests on the defendant to make a prima facie showing, I assume in the motion.
Right.
Is that what you assume?
Yes.
That his plea was accepted without the trial court's conformance, and you tried to do that in your motion, and I accept that for the moment.
Thanks.
Okay. It then goes on, where the defendant has shown a prima facie violation and alleges that he, in effect, did not know or understand the information which should have been provided at the plea hearing, the burden shifts. So my question to you is, does that mean that in every motion you allege, hey, look, this is the plea colloquy, it doesn't fit 97108 or the mandatory procedures, and do you have to allege that the defendant, in fact, did not know or understand the information which should have been provided?
I think you do have to allege that, and where we part company is whether I sufficiently allege that.
That was my next question.
Yes, a simple declarative sentence, he doesn't understand the elements, would have made this whole problem go away.
That's right.
I
agree with you.
And when I drafted this motion, it never dawned on me it would be denied without a hearing. There are so many problems with this colloquy, I couldn't imagine it being denied without a hearing. This court has pending a petition for review, authored by myself, in a case called Bobby Williams. And in that case, and it's 2004 AP 1985 CR, 2004 AP 1985 CR, the reason I mention it, I think it's been ordered published by now. In that case, I filed a motion to withdraw a plea, also out of Judge Wagner's court, within a matter of months of this one. In that case, he granted the motion for plea withdrawal without a Bangert hearing. The state never got their hearing. You just gave me outright plea withdrawal. And the motion, if you compare the motion in this record to the motion on that record, they're 75% the same. And so if I had to do this motion over again, I would have a one-word sentence. The defendant doesn't understand the elements. But I think...
Well, I wouldn't do that if you were relying on me to be happy with what you put in it. And I speak only for myself. I would consider that insufficient unless you could show me the defendant knew what acts made the elements.
Well, that's the problem why I thought your question was so rude, because there's so much missing in this colloquy. There's never a time where the judge says, the state alleges you did this, and this is what constitutes this crime. The state alleges you did that, and this is what an armed robbery is. And do you understand that if you do this, it constitutes a crime of kidnapping? There's none of that back and forth. That's why the whole thing is so amorphous.
Well, but all you had to do was say that the defendant alleges he, in fact, did not know or understand the information that should have been provided at the plea hearing as described above. Because your whole, that may not satisfy Justice Rogensack, but your whole motion is what was missing.
Right.
And you're saying he didn't understand anything that was missing.
He understood, it was so hard to tell what he understood. He understood
Have you met with the client?
Absolutely. Absolutely, absolutely. You know, another problem with the one-word answers, if you look at the plea transcript, the defendant says yeah or yes to questions that don't make any sense. On page 110 of my appendix, and here's a question and answer. The court, they're going through the penalties, and the judge says, I can impose up to 60 years on that. The court can impose up to 60 years on that case, dash, dash. The defense says yeah. The court says, which gives us the extended supervision. Do you understand that? Yeah. Well, I don't understand that. And you got a defendant who's saying yeah or yes to sentences and questions that I don't think any of us understand, which gives us the extended supervision. Do you understand that? Yeah. Well, you know, that's the problem with one-word answers. They don't tell you anything. I see my lights on. I'll just say one last thing if I can. Delegating this to the lawyer disserves everyone. The only person that benefits is the trial judge. It disserves the state. It disserves the defendant. It disserves crime victims who may well have to be testifying years down the road.
I have another question, and that is that one of the rationales for Bandert was that if you were going to have a motion to withdraw the plea and get a hearing on it, if you didn't touch all the bases, that would inspire the prosecutor to step in and fill the cracks, which, for example, I have done in divorce proceedings with judges and opposing counsel, because I want that to be clean and I don't want an appeal. So opposing counsel do that. Is there any indication in the records that you have read that that's happening, that the prosecutor goes in and makes the record?
There are, the experienced prosecutors do. There's a lawyer in a homicide unit, Bill Mauler, who was very careful to make sure when the judge misses something. Judge, could you ask the defendant about this? Or judge, did you read this? And the experienced prosecutors who understand what's at stake do. I think the reality, of course, is you've got a wide range of experience in both the state and the defense bar. Some judges may be a bit reluctant. I'm sorry, some lawyers may be a bit reluctant to offend a judge and say, judge, you kind of missed this. So some do, some don't, just like the answer to your question about pleas.
Okay.
Could I ask you, Mr. Martin, whether Mr. Brown testified in any other case?
No, he did not. And if I could expand on the answer just a couple sentences, because you did ask about Mr. Johnson's case, and this is in the court's database and also on CCAP. Johnson's attorney filed no merit report. Court of Appeals rejected it, said that the plea colloquy wasn't adequate, and it went back for an evidentiary hearing. There was a hearing held, and then later I believe the conviction was affirmed. But that's what happened in Johnson's case. And to my knowledge, none of you...
public record?
Yes, it's in your... Yes, it's all... Everything I told you...
It's pretty public.
What's that?
If it's on CCAP.
Yes. Yes, and also in what used to be WCCA, your database that we can't use right now, but it's all in there, and the rejection of no merit report's in there.
Okay.
So...
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Martin, and thank you, Mr. Walford. Both of you, experienced appellate counsel, whom we see often and are delighted to see you both. Thank you for your arguments today on yet another voluntary, intelligently knowing the waived plea agreement, a plea colloquy. And that ends our 038P2662 CR State versus Brown hearing. The court is in recess until, I think it's December 13th, when we have three more oral arguments to record. We'll meet in the conference room at 3:10.